Come on aboard, I promise you. Lots of room for you on the bandwagon.
Welcome back. It's another edition of the Bandwagon. It's been a little bit of an absence, just things happening and spring break and all
what
sorts
is
of
wrong with us,
crazy
though?
Stuff. But we to make up for it, we're bringing in a new guy.
Yeah, we brought in a new guy.
Introduce yourself, new guy.
My name is John Steinbacher. I'm bringing the white 30-something male perspective to sports, which is something which has really been lacking in the media. So thank you for letting me.
Yeah,
have
I don't
a
know.
Voice.
This is going to be a real game changer for us, I think.
I think it is as well. Well, we're glad to have you, John. John is contributing the rivalry to this edition of the Bandwagon. We'll have a lot more about that coming up in just a little bit here. But also coming up in this edition of the Bandwagon, a guest, which is also worth the wait. Dr. Fred Gertz, economist at the University of Illinois, will be here. We'll be discussing with Fred a little bit about professional athletes and some of the issues they have managing money, why that's such a big problem for them. So we'll be interested to get Fred's insights on that. But let's start off with a couple topics of the week, topics du jour, if you will. The UConn Huskies women's basketball team, just continued domination, y'all.
It feels like basketball happened about 6 months ago. Actually, now with all the baseball news, I feel like basketball never happened. But yes, they have continued their domination, winning their fourth championship in a row, and just like obliterating the competition. They don't just beat them. They completely, it's like the Starkiller base in Star Wars. They just completely destroy everything. So what I find really interesting about it is not necessarily, I mean, we've had lots of conversations about the teams and how that works with recruiting and what kinds of players come and what kinds of other players are available to other teams. What I'm interested in, and we can talk about this and a lot of other things with regards to UConn, is their coach. Mm-hmm. And really, I mean, I saw a thing on ESPN with him where somebody asked him to name like all of their championships and he couldn't even remember what years they'd won. There's been so many. So is he just going to stay and like get to 20? Is that the goal, or is he going to move on?
That's a really good question, John. I don't know what you think. He's certainly been discussed as moving over to the men's college game before. I saw something this week, which was new to me, about the possibility of Gino Auriemma going to the NBA.
Yes.
The question is, are these actual things, or are people just writing stories to write stories? I don't know. Has he said anything? The thing about it is, you know, he's not necessarily a young guy. I think he's, what, like 62? He's still old enough, you know, he could make a transition. But if he's going to do it, he should do it now.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. And it what it reminds me of, and you two could certainly chime in on this as well, it reminds me of the UCLA dynasty under John Wooden in the 60s and 70s, where I think they won 10 titles in 11 years, I think was the number, only interrupted by, I think, North Carolina State beating them in 1974. I think they won 9 straight and 10 of 11. It kind of reminds me of that. You know, I think the rest of women's college basketball, we're starting to see a little bit more parity in it, where it seems like from year to year, there'll be teams that pop up and have good seasons. They'll be ranked. They'll win a conference. They'll make a run even to the Final Four, like we saw, I think, Syracuse and Washington make runs to the Final Four for the first time ever. But no one's been able to knock UConn off that pedestal yet, and I don't know when that's going to happen.
Well, it says, so just referring back to this potential move to the NBA, people are just writing articles citing sources. Sources with a capital S. And what's important to remember here is his contract runs through the 2017-2018 season. It is likely, maybe highly likely, that his team will win two more championships, and then maybe he'll be ready to do something else. Did you know his name is Luigi?
That's awesome.
You guys?
I'd go by Luigi if I were him. I wouldn't
I know.
By Gino.
I know,
pretty
right?
good, too. That's too awesome.
Gino
names.
With an E.
Like
G-E-N-O, I believe, is how it's
yes.
spelled. Anyway, that apropos of nothing, I just wanted to pass that along. But so I think, and I wonder too, like, I've seen like 30 under 30 style documentaries about him and his coaching style, and I just wonder, I wonder how his coaching style might be emulated by more assistants or men or women, frankly, coming in and moving into head coaching positions. Do players want to play for that style of guy? He seems like a fun guy. I've never been to one of his practices. I have no idea. Whatever he's doing, it works. The other thing that I'm curious about, too, just going back to him maybe coaching in the NBA, is how would he – what would the jump be like from coaching college-age women to coaching a bunch of grown-ass men? Like, it's not the same as coaching college-age guys and then coaching grown-ass guys. Mm-hmm. It's like – I think the change in dynamic from female coaching women to men, I don't know. I'm real curious to see how that would work out if that's something that he decided to do.
Yeah, I mean, if there's anybody in the women's game who could do it, it would be Geno. He's certainly got the credibility.
Like, is coaching? Like, it doesn't matter if you're coaching men or women at that point?
At some level, it is, but the games are somewhat different, especially when you're going, as you said, from college women, 18 to 22, to professional men. It is a bit of a different game. So,
all right,
very interesting to see there. The other thing this week, guys, was it just seems to be a rash of knee injuries. Certainly, John, for us as Cubs fans, Illini fans, it was not a good week for that. Kyle,
because I hate the Cubs and I hate the Illini. Just so clear.
Well, you have said you're not a huge football fan.
No, I know, but I don't. Well, whatever. Keep talking.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, and so. Schwarber out, torn ACL for the Cubs. Mikey Dudek for the second straight year out with a torn ACL, the same leg.
So for the non-Uber fans, can you explain who these people are, what positions they play, and why it matters?
Sure. Kyle Schwarber is a second-year player for the Cubs. He is a outfielder slash catcher, a very unusual skill set. But Schwarber's an unusual guy. He basically made it to the major leagues last year because he can hit the crap out of the ball. And they basically found a place for him to play defensively because he's such a good hitter. So the plan was for him this year to catch a little bit more. He was going to catch one of the Cubs starting pitchers, Jason Hamill, every time he pitched. So about 30 games behind the plate, maybe a little bit more here and there, and play, you know, maybe 100 games or so in the outfield, where he's not great, but he tries hard. And
he can do it.
He can do it.
Right.
He could. He had a play or two in the playoffs last year that did not go well, but in the regular season, he didn't look awful out there.
He maybe tried a little too hard last week.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, is that where he hurt himself?
Yeah, he was running toward a fly ball in left center field out in Arizona, which has a really big outfield. And he and the center fielder Dexter Fowler are both going after it. And Fowler collided with Schwarber and basically kind of went right into his thigh, and that impact caused the torn ligaments in his knee, and he's out for the season.
Okay, so that's bad.
Yeah, so that's Schwarber. He's out. And the good thing for the Cubs, they're deep. They've got some players they can put in his spot, and there will be probably a little bit of fall off, but not a ton, hopefully. The Illini football team may be a different story. Mikey Dudek was one of the best wide receivers in the country as a freshman two seasons ago. Last spring, he tore his ACL, I believe his right leg, in practice, spring practice.
In April, right?
Yeah, in April. Almost exactly a year later, in his second practice since coming back, he tore the same leg. Same ligament, same leg, and he is again out for the season. Now, Illinois is not as deep at wide receiver as the Cubs are in the outfield, so it could be a pretty big impact for the Fighting Illini football team.
So unrelated to either of those sports, but I think I sent you guys a link, and we'll definitely put all this in the show notes. In women's soccer, since I'm waving the soccer flag pretty much all the time in here, Erin McLeod, who is the Canadian like women's national team goalkeeper, one of the best goalkeepers in the world.
Yeah,
really at the top of her game. Plays in the U.S. Women's Soccer League as well, or did on March 23rd. She tore her ACL. I think for the second time for sure, and possibly for the third. Mm-hmm. She'll be out for a year at least, maybe two. Won't be going to the Olympics, and she's in her early 30s, and it could feasibly be a career-ending injury. And the thing is when you lose your keeper, I would say, there are other people who can play. you know, we're always happy sometimes, like, oh, so-and-so is getting some playing time. Like, isn't that cute? But really, like, you feel really good when if you're rooting for Canada in that particular game, you're rooting or you feel good about her in the goal. It is a huge loss for them. And these injuries are, like, horrible.
And then, of course, there's Derrick Rose, who, you know, hard to remember and imagine a time where Derrick Rose was considered, you know, a dynamic, amazing.
Isn't he always hurt?
Basketball player.
Yeah.
Now he's just
he was first team All NBA.
Yeah. And I mean, like, it's amazing. And of course, this happens often, how his reputation outside of the game suddenly, you know, all the rumors and innuendos became much more prominent after, you know, a couple of years of injuries and not coming back. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you could do a whole show on the psychological effects of these things. And yeah, I mean, personally,
well, what about the psychological effects on the fandom?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know,
sure.
when players like that get injured, it really takes the wind out of your sails as a fan, I think.
It does. It was interesting to me, and I think Cubs fans know intellectually that this year's team is not about any one guy, maybe with the exception of Jake Arrieta. I think if he got hurt, the Cubs would shrivel up
and blow away
but the Cubs are a deep enough team that an injury to just about any one player isn't enough to really make or break the season. But seeing, you know, Cubs fan reaction on Twitter Friday when the news came out, it was almost complete meltdown. Like, oh no, here we go again. It's, you know, we're gonna spiral out of control. Fortunately, you know, the team really didn't, you know, listen to any of that. They won 3 out of 4 games in the series against Arizona. They won again last night. They're rolling along as we speak at 6-1. They don't seem to be really too worried about it. They're just going to keep playing their game, but it certainly does have an effect on the fandom. So those are a couple of the headlines that caught our eyes this week. It's time to welcome in a guest on this week's edition of The Bandwagon.
We have another guest. So right. You should know that our very first guest was like the was Claw, the Champagne Ladies, like, wrestling team.
Oh, well.
But Dr. Fred Gertz is an economist at the University of Illinois. He's with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. You're probably most familiar with Fred from his monthly Flash Index report that he puts out for the university, gauging economic activity in the state. A less serious topic for you today, Fred, talking about professional athletes and their inability, it seems, in a lot of cases, to manage their money well. Certainly lots of examples cited in the media from all different sports. But as you look at this issue, what do you think is the main cause of these athletes having so many financial difficulties?
Well, I think there are a couple things, at least. The first is the unexpected situation where they get a lot of money very quickly. They're young, and young people tend to have impulse control issues as well. And there's also a general kind of a problem that people don't do a great job managing windfall situations. And the best example of that is lottery winners. There are studies about lottery winners who spent their money very quickly, and they're not even young, and so they probably have fewer excuses. This is also not a new thing. It goes back decades and decades. Some famous examples are Joe Louis ended up close to bankruptcy, and Sugar Ray Robinson was one of the greatest boxers in history and ended up. And he, again, there are all kinds of things. You get a lot of friends when you have money. the idea of entourages. Sugar Ray Robinson was one of the first to have 20 or 30 people hanging around with him and so on. But it's not always that way. There are two Sugar Rays. Sugar Ray Leonard ended up a multimillionaire doing very well, and Sugar Ray Robinson ended up nowhere.
So you mentioned this has been going on for a long time, and I knew that. But so the reason I got interested in this topic was I was on a website called Reddit. Do you know about Reddit?
Yeah.
It's called the front page of the internet. Yeah. It's like the best worst place on the internet, or the worst best place on the internet.
Right.
Anyway, there is a subreddit, so a category called financial independence.
Right.
And somebody was talking about the New England Patriots, Rob Gronkowski,
right,
who has sort of like bragged, both in a book that he's written and in a lot of interviews, about how he hasn't spent any of his NFL money. He lives off of his endorsements, which for Gronk is probably
pretty substantial,
good.
Yeah.
You know, but he has had this sort of streak of this financial independence where he's got this self-control. He's sort of known as a party guy,
right,
you know, but But somehow he's either he's smarter than he looks, or he's just really smart with his money.
Right, and you don't hear about the successes very often. You hear about the failures, and I'm sure there are people with discipline. There are two things about the athletes. Some athletes have a great deal of discipline, and that discipline could carry over to financial areas. Athletes also tend to be cocky and overconfident, and that also can lead to a different direction. The best example of that is Lynn Dykstra. Lynn Dykstra was a player 20, 30 years ago who was a good but not superstar kind of guy. And Billy Beane, who was his roommate at one point, said he had the greatest attitude for baseball because he thought he'd go up against anyone, and no matter how good they were, and he was going to stand in there and hit the ball. But that same kind of overconfidence, in a sense, led him astray in terms of investments. He ended up giving advice to other people and bad advice to them and bad advice for himself, and he ended up not only just bankrupt, but in substantial legal troubles.
So I found this quote online. So I think there's a difference between like being a risk taker and being cocky. There's a line. And so I found this interesting. This quote says, students of behavioral economics may not be surprised to learn that basketball players who demonstrate a preference for long-range, low-percentage three-pointers seem especially likely to run into financial problems when they retire. And there's an article on the NPR website about that, too. So I feel like maybe it's not going to always be position-dependent, obviously.
Right.
But some people are just wired more to engage more risky behaviors that way.
And also there's a kind of information situation that no one's seeking out the guy on the street that earning $12 an hour to get him to invest. But if you're a multimillionaire, there are going to be a lot of people who are going to try to help you. And some of those people aren't really interested in your well-being. They're interested in their own well-being.
So if you're that athlete, how do you find somebody to trust?
Well, I think it's very, very difficult because the people who they're agents now for high school students to get them into college illegally probably. But there are also lots of people around who are trying to get athletes to sign up with them, and the sometimes the more flamboyant and the people that promise the most are the ones that get the people to sign, and they're not necessarily the best best at managing their money. There's kind of a disturbing situation too. If you ask me 10 or 15 years ago, what should an athlete do? Well, maybe sign up with Lee Steinberg, who is the prototypical agent. Jerry Maguire movie was made about him, and he was packaging golfers and all kinds of athletes and doing very well, and ended up he went bankrupt after about 15, 20 years. He has alcohol problems and things. So there's no assurances. But again, it would be easy, you know, if I suddenly got a multi-million-dollar contract to be a baseball player, very unlikely, but I think I could handle the situation pretty well. But could I have done it when I was 20 years old? That's another question.
Yeah, it's certainly a lot of pressure on a young kid who comes into that kind of money. There have been some universities, I think University of Texas, Ole Miss is another one that have started trying to come up with these programs to kind of educate their student athletes in financial issues. Are you aware of any programs in Illinois that are along those lines, Fred?
I think it's more general behavioral things, how to respond to an interview, how to stay out of trouble to the extent that that's possible, things of that sort. I'm sure part of that is managing your money. But you have to think about how many NBA players are there from Illinois. Well, maybe one or two at the most, and more in the NFL, a few baseball players. But it's not of the hundreds of athletes that come here every year, probably two or three have this potential. And so they can't devote huge amounts of time to that. And the other thing, too, which I didn't mention earlier, the world has changed now. There's something called the economics of superstars, and people, whether it's in entertainment or athletics, do much, much better than they did many years ago. There's a story that I heard. Joe Garagiola died recently, but he was talking to someone in an interview, and he said when he was young, he grew up with Yogi Berra, and Yogi Berra is probably one of the greatest catchers of all time, and he was signed from St. Louis, went to New York City to play for the Yankees, and his mother used to send him money so he could live in New York.
Different
times. He didn't have to worry about losing his money in those days.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of those guys, just as an aside, a lot of those guys had jobs in the winter when they weren't playing as well.
So I think also, you know, you bring up the economics of superstars. I think you also, there has to be some sort of discussion about the economics of not quite superstars, because so while $250,000 a year sounds like a lot of money to me, especially to guys, and I'm going to say guys because we're talking, because women in pro sports don't make anywhere near, except maybe in tennis and a few other sports. Guys are groomed in college. They're the big dudes on campus. They're amazing players. And then they go off and they play in Turkey somewhere, or they're playing in some B league, or, you know, they get little, you know, what about the guys who ride the bench most of the time and aren't making a lot of money? Is the temptation there for them to live large also? How they need to be educated about it. It's not such a huge windfall, but it's still probably more money than they're used to.
Yeah, they have to be careful. And then also there's a question of when to quit. First of all, if you go to Turkey, you want to make sure that the money's there. Show me the money kind of situation, because you might get to some place and what they said is true is not necessarily what happens. And the second thing is to know when to quit. I mean, if you're a tennis player just traveling 50 weeks a year and making $80,000. That sounds like a lot, but you're giving up your career prospects in other areas, things of that sort. So you have to make some choices.
It also seems to make sense to me to sort of prepare, especially in a high physical impact sport like football. Injury can end your career really quickly, and you can go from making all of this money to having no money whatsoever.
Right, and I think that's another area of optimism. I'm sure that race car drivers don't expect to be killed in a crash, even though they know it happens. And athletes don't expect to be injured, but they are. I watched the opening day at Busch Stadium yesterday, and I was worried about the Cardinals getting out of the cars. I think they're going to hurt themselves fucking jumping out of the pickup trucks, because so fragile. So things happen like that.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Baseball is a little different. I think baseball has more guaranteed contracts than football, so there's a little bit of security there. And another issue, that there's arguments that not surprisingly that drug use is not recreational drugs, but
performance enhancing
drugs are a strong incentive. So if you're someone in baseball and you can get through those first few years and get a really good long-term contract, then it's hard to control people in that situation.
Well, certainly a lot of issues to keep track of with money and sports. That's one of them today, with athletes trying to handle their newfound millions. Dr. Fred Gertz, economist with the University of Illinois, with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Fred, great to talk to you today.
Right, good to be here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
They are headed off as time runs down. Pistons wasting no time in getting out of here. Now a timeout was called. They left the bench, although there's 7 9/10 seconds remaining.
Now it's rivalry time, and we let the new guy pick out the rivalry this week. John Steinbacher, what do you got for us this time?
Well, I'm not going very deep or hard for...
That's what she said.
Woo! I almost want to just keep that in, because it's not going out on the air, you guys.
It's fine. You can leave it in and just leave me laughing. It's fine.
What? What's so funny?
Yeah, I have no idea.
Yeah, what's up?
So, you know, my thought, just because of what's going on. So, obviously, right now, and I think tonight's the game where Golden State can win 73 games, thus eliminating the 1996-97 Chicago Bulls.
95-96.
Well, I should do some research before I get into this.
It's called pre-production,
as the,
John.
72. So they both are currently tied for 72 wins, and if Golden State wins tonight, they will win 73. So over the course of the last, you know, almost the whole season, but especially the last 2 or 3 months, there's been all these articles written about which team is better. And of course, they ask, you know, Scottie Pippen, and what is he going to say? Oh, the Golden State Warriors would beat us. So there's this media-driven narrative going on right now about the Bulls of the 90s versus the Warriors of today. And, it's interesting, and I don't have any problem with them talking about it, but one of the things that's sort of happened is the mystical Bulls of the 90s have sort of turned into the, you know, bitter former champions who, you know, are, you say, we're better than everyone else and rooting for them to lose, even though I'm not sure any of this happens. You know, they aren't like the Miami Dolphins who come out publicly and are popping champagne bottles. Of course, they couldn't do that anyway because the record went down. But anyway, got me thinking about my youth and, you know, the biggest rivalry when I was growing up, and I'm sure a lot of people who are from this area, the Pistons of the late 80s versus the Bulls of the late 80s, early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Pistons were famous. They were the bad boys.
I hated those guys.
They had Isaiah Thomas. You know.
And I wasn't a big Bulls fan. I was a Lakers fan. Yeah. They're the ones who ended the Lakers run in the 80s. I hated those guys, too.
Isaiah Thomas, Rick Mahorn, Dennis Rodman. And I think it's probably the most hated, one of the most hated NBA players of all time, Bill Laimbeer.
Yeah. But the only guy you didn't hate on that team was Joe Dumars.
Yeah. Anyways, very interesting, narrative arc for the Bulls. They had something called the Jordan rules, which was basically beat the crap out of Michael Jordan.
Yeah, push him around, knock him down.
Right.
And we'll include those in the show notes, by the way.
And there's even a book about it. Well, not necessarily about the Jordan rules. It's called Jordan rules. I think it's partially about that, partially about, you know, a season with Michael Jordan. But anyway, you know, the Bulls versus the Pistons. The Pistons were the bad boys. Michael Jordan was this, you know, let's be honest, mythological 1980s sort of, you know.
Almost a superhero.
Almost type superhero guy. Type guy. And the Pistons were his villains.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, growing up as a kid, I was like 10 or 11 when this first started. And, you know, I hated the Pistons. Michael Jordan was everything, you know, nothing wrong with him. Of course, I think that's partially being a kid. I think there was some stuff at the time, you know, gambling and all that stuff. I'm not sure exactly when that stuff came out. But, you know, there were the Pistons. The Bulls made it to the semifinals, and the Pistons knocked them out 1 year. Then the next year, they beat them out of the Eastern Conference Finals. The year after that, it went 7 games. I remember, like, the Bulls had won Game 6, and everyone was like, this is it. And then I think in Game 7, Scottie Pippen had an infamous migraine headache, and they lost.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just this ultimate, you know, it was the ultimate, like, good versus evil. And, obviously, in 1991, the Bulls finally vanquished, really, Michael Jordan finally vanquished his ultimate foes, which were the Pistons. Obviously, a great rivalry. The media played it up. They played up Michael Jordan as the savior of the NBA and the bad boys. Obviously, they reveled in it. They didn't back down. You know, give them credit. They loved the image. You know, obviously, they had a great coach, Chuck Daly, who created the Jordan rules, and it took Phil Jackson and his triangle offense to defeat the Jordan rules, which is, you know, kind of hilarious in and of itself. And then, of course, the most infamous moment of all, when the Bulls sweep the Pistons out of the playoffs with like 6 seconds left in the game. Isaiah Thomas, Bill Laimbeer, I forget who else.
Mahorn
just walk off get taken out of the game and walk off the court so they don't have to shake hands with the Bulls.
Yeah, just go straight to the locker room.
Right. So anyway, that is to me like my ultimate childhood rivalry. And obviously, you know, it's got this really amazing story arc from a, you know, just even a literary standpoint of, the savior comes along or superhero comes along. Can't defeat the evil bad guys and then eventually, you know, vanquishes them and then goes on to, you know, win 6 more titles and, you know, basically
untold riches.
You know, 1990 is the last season that Michael Jordan, and I'm not talking about Washington Wizards Michael Jordan, the last full season that Michael Jordan played basketball that didn't end in him, you know, winning the NBA title, which is pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. So one thing that I heard while you were talking, and you brought it up, is the whole superhero thing.
Yeah.
And so in 1991 or 1990, whenever you were a kid and listening, like, you didn't have the Marvel universe and you didn't have all of these superhero movies. Star Wars was nowhere close to being rebooted. So I think when you were a kid, it sounds to me like that this was sort of that, you know. Do kids now experience those kinds of rivalries in pro sports? Because I feel like they are so much more distracted by movies and entertainment and apps and everything else. And sure, they like sports too. There are plenty of kid athletes who love sports. But I just wonder if those rivalries are experienced the same way by kids, given superhero movies and Captain America and Iron Man, all that stuff.
Yeah, I think part of it is that, you know, when John and I and you were growing up, there were so many fewer options that, you know, there was on Sundays, you watched the NBA game that was on, you know, I know I did.
Mm-hmm.
Or during the baseball season on Saturdays, you watched the game of the week that was on for baseball or whatever else. And cable started to come along and you started to have some more choices. But even then, you didn't have, you know, everything on demand that you could watch what you wanted whenever you wanted to. You watched what was on. And
just total immersion.
Yeah. Right.
You can't go anywhere without being surrounded by that stuff, even out in the physical
and
world.
And on Saturday mornings, like after cartoons were over, and of course here I am talking about being a kid and I was like 12, which is kind of embarrassing. But there was like NBA Jam Time with Ahmad Rashad. And of course he got all the inside interviews because he's best friends with Michael Jordan. Watching that, you know, there's this whole thing built up. But, the other interesting thing about it to me, looking back, and I think part of it was being a child and having this media-driven image of Michael Jordan and the Bulls, you know, force-fed. Obviously, you know, David Stern, the commissioner, loved it.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Jordan, the most popular human being on the planet. And I think it helped to be at a different time. Obviously, you didn't have Deadspin. You don't have, you know, can you imagine how many pictures with TMZ there'd be of Michael Jordan at a, you know, gambling, doing all kinds of terrible things. I mean, you know, and he's sort of shed his own image over the years, too. You know, he famously, during his Hall of Fame speech, went after, but, you know, he's ultra competitive. And, you know, as a kid, I saw that as, you know, amazing. And now you kind of look back and you're like, he's kind of, you know, he's the best athlete of probably of all time, certainly of the end of the 20th century. He's an amazing media figure, but you know, the narrative was so clear to me when I was young, and mm-hmm. now you like look back at it, and it's like, yeah, the Bulls weren't all that great either.
But that's just grown-ups anyway, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, you realize all of a sudden that your parents are human beings, or like, you know, people are fallible, and mm-hmm. I think that is sort of the experience that you were talking about. So just a funny aside about the Bulls in that era, probably a little bit further on. My son, who is now almost 24 years old, he used to call Scottie Pippen Biscotti Pippen. Biscotti. He thought his name was Biscotti and that we weren't saying his name correctly.
That's
amazing. I just
wanted
to throw that in. Isn't that great? I like the name trivia. That's what I'm bringing to this conversation today.
Would you like a Biscotti Pippen with your coffee today?
Oh, like we'd go to a coffee shop and he would order Biscotti Pippen.
And then just as a quick side note to hear, I think you can't bring up this the Michael Jordan Bulls and the Hall of Fame speech without what has probably become the longest lasting meme of all time. I mean, this Michael Jordan crying meme started, it's like 6 months ago or something, and it's still going strong.
I think it's actually going to go down in the history of memes as being one that everybody just brings back, kind of like, you know, winter is coming and that, all of those, like people are just going to add
evergreen.
Exactly. It's an evergreen meme.
But yeah, I mean, just thinking like if you could take me back to being like, you know, 12 years old and liking Michael Jordan and thinking like, you know, 20 from a lot of years from now,
let's not talk about it.
A lot of years from now, he's going to be like the butt of jokes every time something bad happens. Like I saw, what is the par three on the Masters that,
Ernie Els had his 12 on or whatever.
Yeah, and that Jordan Spieth blew like a
quadruple bogey.
Yeah, I saw that someone had made it in the shape of Jordan's head, crying head. So I should find that. We should put that up.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. We'll have we'll have the video that you sent around for us to watch and a few other links. We'll put those in the show notes in the link section on the World Wide Web later.
Yes, indeed. The small I internet.
The small I internet, exactly.
Yes. All right. Well, John Steinbacher, thanks for your contribution on the rivalry this week. Good stuff, my friend.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us.
It's a I have to be very careful how I phrase this. It's wonderful to be here.
Oh.
Well said in your golf announcer voice.
Yes, golf clap. No, just clap. Thank you. Thanks, John.
Well, I think, folks, we are about out of time for this edition of the Bandwagon Sports Podcast.
This is my shining moment here on the podcast. Always reading the end credits. Thank you from all three of us for joining us today on the Bandwagon, where we feel compelled to remind you that there is plenty of room for everyone and that the horse will be okay. Bandwagon is produced by us, Lisa Braltz, that's me, John Steinbacher, and Brian Moline. Brian records us and edits us and puts us on the small I internet.
Mm-hmm.
Like a boss. Scott Cameron is WILL's Director of News and Public Affairs, and this podcast was totally his idea, so you can direct all your complaints to him and all the compliments to us.
Of course.
Jim Kelly designed our logo, which you can't see yet, but you will soon. And he also suggested our theme song. This band called REM wrote it. So speaking of logo, we're still working on that Bandwagon web presence. But for now, you can locate past episodes of The Bandwagon at will.illinois.edu, as well as links to the articles we discuss, some videos, and some show notes. We'd love your feedback via email, or if you'd prefer to start a conversation online, you can go ahead and ping us on Twitter at
BMOLLY, W-I-L-L.
I'm at Lisa Braltz, and you got to say yours.
Be sure.
It's Steinbacher with no vowels, but still.
Yes.
So S-T-N-B-C-H-R.
Just find us on the web. Anyway, so next episode of The Bandwagon is coming your way in a couple of weeks. I figure that's probably a pretty good estimate. Well, we have a webpage by then. It is the eternal question. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening.
Catch you later.